This is the second tape in a series by Thomas B. Taylor, Associate Professor of Church History and Old Testament at Biblical Theological Seminary.
We proceed then today with our third study in Ecclesiastes, and what we are looking at is the second discourse. In our first study, we talked about the prologue with the background material of the book, making notes on transient man and his world. And in the second discourse, we talked about the basic facts of life, which we will not repeat now, but which, if they are not accepted, there is no progress. So perhaps one word along that general thrust. The study of a book like Ecclesiastes is very much like the building of a tower or a temple. If the foundation is not correctly laid, you cannot proceed on it. And you'll find people who will want to ask you questions about verses in Ecclesiastes 9, Ecclesiastes 10, and various detailed concepts in the book. The problem with some of them, at least, is that they've missed the foundation of the book. The foundation is that we are being shown how transient we are in a world that God has created, and that if we do not accept the basic facts of life as God gives them to us and do not act on them, then we cannot hope to have a happy end to what we're trying to do. So if somebody thinks that they can control all the forces of nature, if somebody thinks that they can harmonize all the events in life that seem disharmonious, if someone believes that they ought to be able to lay out everything in perfection before themselves, they have missed the facts of life, and they will be confused in their treatment of life and of the book of Ecclesiastes too. So we come today to the second discourse proper, which is Ecclesiastes 3:1 through Ecclesiastes 6:12. Now that is a fairly heavy block of material, and we will not be able to treat it on a verse-by-verse section. However, we will try to touch on all those verses that seem particularly difficult, and we'll try to put it together in a number of segments so that we can keep our mind on it and have some accurate appreciation of what it's trying to say. This, then, the second discourse of Ecclesiastes, talks about the quality of life that is lived before man and God. That's a rather broad subject, but that's what the writer views. He surveys life in relation to the life that we are now living and the death that we shall someday die. He looks at all the events that transpire in that life and the things that will be consummated in that death. And he says to us there is a real quality of life, man, as it's lived before God. Life is ours to have and enjoy, but having it and enjoying it are possible only if we live it before God. I ought to summarize that in some shorter form, I suppose. The discourse proposes that the quality of life as lived before man and God is meaningful only as we accept what God gives and honors him in it. That becomes the heart of Ecclesiastes chapters 3 through 6. When we eventually come to the third discourse, we will find it discussing values of life and materials in which we ought to look at life. But in these chapters, chapters 3 through chapter 6, the big thrust is on the quality of life as we live it before God and man. And the point is simply this. This life that you now possess by God's goodness is yours to have and enjoy. But the having of it and the enjoying of it are only possible as we live it before God and accept his standards for it. Now, the particular chapters before us, 3 through 6, are sufficiently long that we'll take a moment and divide them into their various segments. I divide the chapters into 5 segments. Let me tell you what each of the segments is, and let me mention a broad teaching concept for it. And then when we've done that, we'll come back and look at them in greater detail. The first of the segments is the poem of time, which is found in Ecclesiastes 3, 1 through 15. Ecclesiastes 3, 1 through 9 is the technical poem, 10 through 15 is the addition or conclusion added to it. So the emphasis of the first segment is that you have time for everything necessary in life if you accept the time God gives and live it for him. That's the poem of time in Ecclesiastes 3, verses 1 through 15. The second segment is one that relates to differing destinies, talking about the difference between men and animals, and talking about the difference between men who are wise before God and men who are not wise before God. This segment involves Ecclesiastes 3:16 through Ecclesiastes 4:3. Rather an awkward place to make the break, but you'll have to remember that the chapter divisions and verse divisions were added to the Bible by men like ourselves many years after it was originally written. I often don't make discussions or arguments about them, but this is one that I wish they had divided a little differently. Other scholars might or might not agree. But the differing destinies concept is Ecclesiastes 3:16 through 4:3. And the emphasis is that if you will watch your destiny, if you will watch where you're headed and how you're going, then the quality of life is greatly improved. So the quality of life is better if you take things in due time and if you watch the destiny towards which you are headed. The third segment is Ecclesiastes 4:4 through 4:16. It relates to the importance of understanding. Understanding basic concepts in life, understanding basic ideas that God gives to us. Now, not all of the items for understanding are surveyed in this particular chapter, but quite a number of them are, and they are some items which are almost overly simplistic in form, but are often missed by us in the hurry of life. So the thrust in these verses, Ecclesiastes 4:4 through 4:16, is the importance that if you understand what God wills and what God does, then the quality of life is greatly improved. The fourth segment is Ecclesiastes 5:1 through 20. Ecclesiastes 5:1 through 20. And here the matter is one of the concepts of behavior, behaving well and behaving wisely. We may look at that in some detail in this particular discussion, but that's a big thing. Many of our problems are made by ourselves as we conduct ourselves improperly or indecorously. So in Ecclesiastes 5:1 through 20, you have the concepts of behavior, and the emphasis is there's a great improvement in the quality of life if you behave right. And then the final segment in this second discourse of Ecclesiastes is the concept of being satisfied, having a satisfied being in Ecclesiastes 6:1 through 12. The emphasis that the writer will make there is that if you follow good, that is, the knowledge of God and His will, you will be satisfied and find the things that are necessary for the contentment of your soul. The whole discourse discusses the quality of life as one lives before man and God. And in a nutshell, the writer says, if you take the time and allot it as God gives it, if you keep an eye on your destiny and where you will be and where you are going, if you understand the mysteries of life and make a stress on that understanding, if you behave properly, if you follow that which is good, the quality of your life will be greatly improved before God. That doesn't mean the quantity of it will be greatly improved, nor does it mean your possessions will multiply, nor does it mean anything else, but it means that the quality of your life, the peace and the assurance and the satisfaction, the things that are really important in life, that they will be greatly increased for you as you live before men and God. So if one wants a life of quality, if one wants a life in which the valuable things are emphasized and realistic, then what one wants to do is to come back to this section of Ecclesiastes and say, what will enrich my life? What will make it rich? And the writer of the book says, what will make it rich is keeping things in their right time, marking the destinies well, making it a point to understand God's will and God's program, behaving honestly, and following the things that are set for good. Now, that is all by way of introduction, I suppose, to the second discourse. I've tried to mention the five segments into which it falls, and have tried to discuss the overall theme of it. Now, let us go to each of these segments and look at it in some greater degree of detail. Let's look first at the poem of time. If you're situated in a place where you may have your Bible with you, you'd find it to your advantage to follow me. Of course, if you're driving your car, paying attention to the road is the chief thing to do. But if your Bible is close enough to have reference to, then you would find it well to follow me as we look now at the poem of time. The poem of time encompasses Ecclesiastes 3, 1 through 15. The formal poem is Ecclesiastes 3, 1 through 9. And these words are so well known that they become the basis for popular songs and modern music and a couple operatic productions and a few librettos from light opera and many other things. The writer goes through all the things that are important to us. And he says as in verse 1, to everything there is a season and a time to every person under the earth. And then following that, he mentions the things that are important. Birth, dying, planting, picking, killing, healing, breaking down, and building up. Times of weeping and mourning and laughing and dancing. Times to bring things together and times to set things apart. Times to get for yourself and times to share with others. He takes a whole gamut of life things in Ecclesiastes 3, 1 through 9, and he said all of these things have a set place in time in your life. It is not so much a matter of how long you live. It's a matter of the way things are arranged. So the emphasis is that you take each thing as it comes to you and seek to utilize it to the fullest. For to all there is a season, and to every bit there is a purpose under the heaven. Now, we lose a lot of things in life because when they come to us, we do not fully enter into them. I watched a person at a party one night. I often have had the same experience myself. They obviously were not a party-going type. There are some of us like that. They were obviously not a party-going type. And the poor fellow was perfectly wretched and made no attempt to conceal it. He stood off by the side of the wall and scowled and looked ugly. And of course, all you do in a situation like that is spoil other people's events too. I'm not a party goer. And before I was able to improve my philosophies, that's what I used to do. Go to the party and stand around and look grouchy. Well, says the writer of Ecclesiastes, there is a time. There is a time to laugh, and there is a time to cry. If you go to the party and don't laugh, you've missed your time. That's awfully simplistic, but that's it. That may be your opportunity, quote, for enjoyment of life. And if you don't take it, you've missed it. And here comes somebody into your presence who's had a great life sorrow. Somebody who has great trial, needs comfort and help and consolation. And you look at them without any concern or care and let them pass by. You have missed your opportunity to cry legitimately. You may someday cry illegitimately, but you've missed your opportunity for sharing. When the writer says that there's a time to dance, a time to rejoice, a time to get, a time to rend, a time to love, he merely emphasizes that to those who organize their lives before God, all the things necessary for them come in their right time. It doesn't make any difference if you live 20 years or 100 years. There's time for everything that's important if the events of life are consecrated before God. And the way in which they are consecrated before God is by taking them and living them to the fullest, giving him praise for what he's done and utilizing all the gifts that he's blessed you with. What a beautiful thing the poem of time is. Sometimes when you're growing up, you think that there will not be enough time for all the things you want to do in life. And there won't be if you don't dedicate your time to God. But if you learn to take the events of each occasion and each day with maximum thanksgiving and with dedication, then there's time for everything that has to be done. And someone says, well, suppose I don't live that long. Suppose I die in my teens. Well, if you die as a believer, the soul is blessed in the presence of God. But at the moment that life is complete, you have had time and the satisfaction in time that all God wanted for you was yours. I'm not really trying to be a Pollyanna type on it, but the poem of time says it just very beautifully. There is a time for everything, and you may participate in all of those things if you take the events of life as they come to you and use them for the honor of God. Now, after the writer has spelled out the little poem in itself, he raises the question in verse 9, which introduces the second part of the poem of time. What profit does he have that works in all wherein he labors? Verse 10, he says, I've seen the travail which God has given the sons of men to be exercised in it. I've seen the struggles they have in life and how they try to know what God wants, he said. But verse 11 is a positive note. God has made all beautiful in its time. Also, he has set the world in their hearts so that no man can find out the work that God maketh from the beginning to the end. That verse is not easily translated. The King James perhaps does not do it as well as some other versions do it. It is not easily translated, but here is the thrust of it. God has made it so that everything has a time of fullness, and it's beautiful in its time. Beautiful in its time. And in the heart of every man is locked the knowledge of eternity, so that every man wonders about time. That's the concept in the phrase, he hath set the world in their heart. Eternity is the idea. In the heart of every man is the sense of eternity. God has made everything beautiful in its time. In the heart of every man is locked the sense of eternity, so that every man would like to know more of what God is doing, but cannot find it out in detail. So within us there is an ongoing quest, within us an ongoing search, a desire to know and a desire to find out, not bad things or scary things, but the beauty of the creation that God has established. Now, says the writer, I know that in man there's no good. And the best thing for him to do in verse 12 is to rejoice and to do good in his life. He takes each thing as it comes in time and commits it to God. And the result is that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of all of his labor. It's the gift of God. That does not prescribe a life of gluttony. The phraseology is found often in Ecclesiastes. What it says is that if God puts a glass of milk before you, you take it and drink it from God and you do it thankfully. If it's a loaf of bread or a pecan pie, you take it and do it gladly in the presence of God. And there's nothing better than to take his time and the gifts he gives and use them wisely. Because, says the writer in verse 14, a very important verse incidentally, I know that whatever God does, it's done forever. Nobody can put anything to it, and nobody can take anything from it. God does it, and God does it that men might stand in respect of Him. Everything which is past done, everything which has been in the mind of God is now. And everything that is going to come, God already knows about and requires your response in it. Now, sometimes if we put our thoughts together too rapidly, they're just like so much mush in a chapter like this. But here's the essence of it. The writer says there is time for everything necessary in life if you take the events as they come and live them for God. And the Lord has helped you to do that by placing the knowledge of eternity in your heart so that you will think about Him. You won't be able to know everything, but you will think about Him, and you will know that what He does is done forever. Consequently, the important thing is for you to dedicate your days and times to Him and your activities to His will. That should not need a lot of amplification. But I find in my own mind that it often is just very vague. I get pressed with a schedule from day to day, and I'm trying to do today what ought to be done tomorrow. I don't mean you should put off today's work till tomorrow, but I'm often greatly concerned with today about what can't be done until tomorrow. Went to a birthday party not long ago. In the middle of the birthday party, I got thinking about the sermons to be delivered on Sunday, 2 or 3 days later. I had to stop for a moment and say, what am I doing? Am I in a sermon writing clinic or am I in a birthday party? So I tried to make a few notes in the sermons and leave them in my coat and return and enjoy the party. You see, it's complicated to say it, but it was not the time for sermon writing. It was the time for rejoicing and making someone else's day happy. Now, if you say, then when does the time for sermon writing? It always comes. It's never failed yet. It always comes. And so the emphasis is, trust God with your time. That greatly increases your quality of life. You don't have to drive yourself crazy trying to get everything done. And you don't have to say to yourself, why can't I accomplish anything? Yielded time to God will accomplish what pleases Him. So in the third discourse, where the writer talks about the quality of life, where the writer discusses the important aspects of what we are doing, the quality of time shows up as being very important to us. And he says, if you commit your time to God, the quality of your life will be vastly improved. In the second segment of this discourse, in the second segment of it, the writer talks about differing destinies. The scripture again is over in chapter 3 at verse 16 through chapter 4 and verse 3. There are some strange verses here. The writer begins by saying, I saw under the sun, Ecclesiastes 3:16, the place of judgment, that wickedness was there, and the place of righteousness, that iniquity was there. That might seem like a paradox, but the writer is simply saying that there's no set order in life that guarantees everything will be the way I want it to be. But although he saw wickedness in the place of judgment and saw iniquity in the place of righteousness, he says in his heart in verse 17, God shall judge the righteous and the wicked, for there is a time there for every purpose and for every work. Where are the wicked headed? God knows. Sometimes the wicked in their ways get in the place of righteousness. Sometimes they get in the church. In some of these churches today where a liberal or no gospel is preached, in the place where righteousness ought to be declared, wickedness is heard from the pulpit Sunday after Sunday. I don't think believers should have any part in such things, but it happens that way sometimes. And the writer of Ecclesiastes says, in time, God will judge it. In time, God will judge it. So you see, there is a difference in destiny. The fact that the wicked get in the place where the righteous are does not mean they're going to the place where the righteous go. Nor does it mean they are going to have the reward that the righteous have. There's a difference in destiny. And the emphasis is, in verse 17, make sure that you are one of those righteous that God is looking for. I said in mine heart concerning the estates of the sons of man that God might show them and let them see that they are beasts, says the writer. Now, this is a striking thing. Beasts is really living creatures. It doesn't mean that we are insensitive animals, but living creatures. Let men see that they are living creatures. They are not monuments that will last forever. They are not angels who have no normative lifespan, but they are living creatures. Consequently, in the next few verses, they all die. That's what man must see. He must see that in terms of the breath that sustains life, he is no different from a dog. Put either one of them in a plastic bag long enough, and they will both be equally dead. When the writer says in verse 20, all are of dust and all turn to dust again, there he speaks of the body, the man who is a beast and the living creature who goes with him. In verse 21, rhetorically, he lets us know that the spirit of man goes upward and the spirit of the beast goes downward. Some read Ecclesiastes 3:21 to imply that the writer does not know which way the spirits go. And if it were the only verse you had on the subject, then it might be a possible understanding. But interpreting Ecclesiastes 3:21 in the terms of Ecclesiastes 12, we know that the spirit goes to God who gave it. And the writer in Ecclesiastes 3 is anticipating that, saying, who knows, who knows, who sees it, who understands it? The spirit of man returning to God and the spirit of beast going downward. There is a difference, but men must realize in the difference between themselves that there is a common foe before them all in the terms of the grave. In the light of that, he said, I perceive there's nothing better than that a man should rejoice in his own work, for this is his portion. For who shall bring him to see what shall be after him? Why should he worry about tomorrow? Why should he be greatly concerned about what his heirs will do with his fish pond when he's gone? Let him rejoice in today and what God does for him, and then let him see how things go tomorrow. However, the discussion of differing destinies continues in chapter 4 in the first three verses. The writer says, I looked and I saw that there were lots of oppression. Oppression means something which is unequal or difficult. Lots of difficulties, unequal things done under the sun. And I saw the tears of such as were oppressed, and they had no comforter. And on the side of their oppressors there was power, but they, the oppressed, had no comforter. Why, it often seems that way in life. The poor and the meek and the victimized seem to be in difficulty, while the wretched ones who are causing it seem to go on in strength. Oh, says the writer, I saw that. And because I saw it, I praised the dead which are already dead more than the living. Their account is finished, and they are delivered from these inequities. What's more, I looked back and I said that the one is better than either of them who has never yet been born and has not seen the evil work that is done under the sun. Now, verses like that in Ecclesiastes are often taken in a very negative way. But here's the concept. The writer is talking about destinies, about the way in which we differ in the course of life. He has already told us that God will judge the wicked and God will take care of the righteous. Now we look about and we see the oppressed suffering and we see the oppressor being strong. We feel very overcome with bad emotions. Don't do it, says the writer of Ecclesiastes. There is a differing destiny there, and God will bring things to fulfillment in his own time. The oppressor will get what he deserves, and those who are oppressed will be raised in the glories and mercies of God. If one stands back and says, well, I would like to see that done now, the writer of Ecclesiastes very simply says, to everything there is a season and a time. You cannot rush that. If you ran out and shot the oppressor today, you would not gain anything. It'd probably put you in prison and you'd never be free the rest of your life. So to everything there's a season and a time. And the quality of life is greatly enriched when one observes the differing destinies and allows God to execute his will in them. The third segment is Ecclesiastes 4, verses 4 through 16. And here is one of those beautiful poetic passages in Ecclesiastes in which the writer talks at great length about understanding the importance of some very, very basic issues. Ecclesiastes 4, 4 through 16. What he is saying is that if you understand these basic issues, then the quality of life and the value of it is greatly improved. Forgive me for returning so often to that phrase, but that's a very meaningful thing to me. The quality of life is the sense of satisfaction and peace and blessing. It's never related to how much money you have or how many places you've gone. It always relates to what you feel you've accomplished and achieved and how your life has gone. And in this second discourse, the writer is telling us how it ought to go. He's saying, look at the quality of life you have before God and man. Do you take things in time and dedicate them to God? Do you observe the destinies that God's appointed and find yourself living in the light of them? And do you understand the various aspects of things that God has called to our attention that we ought to look at? If you have your Bible nearby, note Ecclesiastes 4 and the following verses. The writer says, I considered all travail, that means work. I considered all travail, every kind of travail, and every good work, right work, that for this a man is envied of his neighbor. This is vanity and vexation of spirit. The fool folds his hands together and eats his own flesh. Better is a handful with quietness than both hands full with travail and vexation of spirit. Well, here's something to understand. All the works that are done, good, bad, and otherwise, will produce somebody that envies them and wishes that they possess them. That's a generalization. Of course, there might be one here and one there that doesn't get into that or doesn't suffer from it. But the writer says, I saw all the works that are done and how they promote envy in a neighbor. Some years ago in the city of Pittsburgh, there was I don't remember if it actually went to court or if it was threatened to court, but at least a threatened lawsuit. A man in a rather well-to-do section got tired of fighting crabgrass summer after summer in his lawn, so he had the whole lawn plowed up and sowed with crabgrass. He said he was not going to fight it anymore. He was going to have the best crabgrass lawn in the country. Of course, his neighbors, I don't know if it went to court or not, his neighbors were incensed. They were trying to get crabgrass out, and they threatened suit and legal procedure and everything else. I saw the lawn many times, I might say, and in the months of June and July and August, it was a beautiful lawn. Crabgrass just looks ugly as anything in September and October, but in the summer, he had a beautiful lawn. But his neighbors envied him. They didn't want it. They hated him for it, which is really what envy means. They didn't want his lawn. They envied him for what he had done and for his independence and spirit of his character. Well, says the writer, all this envy is vanity and vexation of spirit. Now the fool, he says, the fool doesn't pay any attention to the circumstance in which he's in. He doesn't mean the fool literally eats his own flesh, but he says the fool pays no attention. The fool is not going to be envious, hardly. He pays no attention. He folds his hands and pretends it's a sandwich and thinks that will satisfy him, as the case may be. And on the other hand, those who are wise will learn that what they have comes from God, and they will take it with their hands and be thankful for what God has given, knowing that if they had a great deal with travail and with strife, others would only want it anyway and cause them great grief over it. That sometimes isn't so easy to understand. We would all like to have more things in several different directions, but the emphasis here is pretty simple. Be content with what God gives. Don't be lazy about it, but be content with it. Take it and use it for the glory of God. That's your goods. If you had tons of it, thousands of people would envy you and make your life miserable trying to get it from you. It's like being a wealthy person and letting religious organizations know that you'll give them money. Hundreds of people would try to get it from you. On the other hand, if you're a fool, you would think you were content when you had nothing. But you're not a fool. You can hear and you can understand. So take what God gives and enjoy it. Then in the next few verses of Ecclesiastes 4, the writer talks about your work effort and the things that you do. I returned and saw under the sun, there's one alone, and there's not a second. Here's a man who lives alone. He's a bachelor. He has no children. He has no brother. He has neither child nor brother. See, he lives alone, but he's prospered. Yet there is no end of all his labor. Neither is his eye satisfied with riches. Neither does he say, what am I doing all this work for? And you see the picture in there very beautifully. Here's an individual who lives alone. He has nothing. He has no brother. He has no son. He has no daughter. He has no wife. He's by himself, but he's piling it up by the tons. The point of understanding is that you should see that if your work is expended merely for yourself, it will produce aggravation and grief to you. And so I need to understand that. When I go out to work, when I go out to set a project in motion, for whom am I doing it? If it's just for me, it will produce largely grief. It'll be a great travail. Eventually it won't satisfy me, and I'll have to leave it in the hand of somebody who may not even care for it. So we need to understand that. We need to understand that our goods are maximum useful to us, and we are thankful for them, and we sit back and enjoy them by the will of God. And we need to understand that our work is meaningful to us when it accomplishes something for somebody else and not just for ourselves. And then there's the matter in verses 9, 10, and 11 of one's fellowship. Two are better than one, says the writer. They have a good reward for their labor. They can do more, and they share the reward with others. I love the fish. And I can go fishing at the drop of a worm, so to speak. I enjoy fishing enormously. But you know, there's a lot less reward in going fishing if there's nobody at home to bring the fish home to. I shouldn't speak for all fishermen because I have a wife and children and other people who enjoy seeing me come home with fish, as long as they're the right kind of fish. But there's nothing harder than working and making a great achievement and not being able to share it with anyone. Grover Cleveland was the President of the United States years ago. And in due course, he was present to see the inauguration of James McKinley. Stephen, his mother had been a widow. His father had been a Presbyterian minister. His mother had been a widow who had raised a lot of children alone. And they asked Cleveland of the inauguration of McKinley, how he felt about things and so forth. And Cleveland noted, he said he envied McKinley nothing in the world except that he had the privilege of having his mother there that day to see him made President of the United States. What Cleveland was saying was, if you have a great reward but nobody to share it with, it doesn't mean nearly so much. Two are better than one. Not only do they do more, but they encourage and help one another. If one falls, the other one picks him up. If one's cold, the other one can warm him. They are enabled to stand together, so if somebody prevails against one, the other one will come to his aid. After all, says Coalesce, the threefold cord is not quickly broken. That which is bound and wrapped and laced together is not easily set apart. So there is an importance of fellowship. You understand that we need the company and strength of one another. It may be that some men have had to serve God in very lonely places in accord with his will and dealing. That well may be. But that is not the desired or the ordinary case. What's desired and ordinary is that we have the company and the association of one another. And when we take advantage of that, forgive me for saying it again, the quality of our life is greatly improved. And then in the last few verses of chapter 4, the writer says, let me tell you about a poor and wise child, that he's better than an old and foolish king who won't be admonished. So in chapter 4, in the importance of understanding, he first wants us to understand our goods, and then to understand our work effort, and then to understand the importance of our fellowship, and then to understand the nature of our character. If you get to a point of life where you will not listen, you have lost your value. You're like that poor old king. He comes out of prison. We assume that means the womb, to reign. He comes out to reign. But the people that are in his kingdom are poor because of his poverty and reigning. Now, says the writer, I looked at all the living that walk under the sun with the second child that shall stand up in his stead. I looked at all of the living under the sun, and I looked ahead to the ones that would follow them. There's no end of the people, no end of them. All that have been before them, they also that come after them, they will not rejoice in the previous generation. That doesn't mean they won't be glad for it, but they cannot live its life. And that's why it doesn't help much to tell people how good things were when you were a child. Nobody can go back and live then. When I tell my children that when I was a boy, ice cream cones only cost 3 cents each, all I do is increase their vexation at life because their ice cream cones cost 40 cents a piece or 50 cents a piece or whatever the traffic will bear. So they don't rejoice in my life. I hope they rejoice with me as their father, and I hope they're thankful for what God has done. But they cannot live and enjoy my life. They have to live and enjoy their own. And they have to understand that their character needs to be rooted in being willing to listen to God and being taught. Now, this has been the third segment in the second discourse. If I twist these numbers around long enough, they're bound to come out in some strange fashion. But the third segment is the importance of understanding. The fourth segment in Ecclesiastes 5 is the concept of behavior. And the thrust here in our discourse is that if you behave well, the quality of life is enriched. Verses 1 through 7 talk about the behavior before God. My, how easily we forget this. Note what the writer says. Keep thy foot when thou goest to the house of God, and be more ready to hear than to give the sacrifice of fools, for they consider not that they do evil. Be not rash with thy mouth, and let not thine heart be hasty to utter anything before God, for God is in heaven and thou upon earth. Therefore let thy words be few. I've kind of enjoyed a random thought in verses 1 and 2 of Ecclesiastes 5. He starts by saying, keep your foot, and he goes into verse 2 by saying, not be rash with your mouth. It seems to me what he's saying is, don't put your foot in your mouth. I think, that's a crude way to put it, friend, but it seems to me that's what he's saying. Make your conduct before God sure and honest. Don't make big promises. Don't make big claims. Don't vow and not pay. And don't, in verse 6, let your mouth sin and blame it on somebody else. Don't do those things. Fear God, he says in verse 7. Respect God. And the respect of God leads you to worship him and praise him without making big claims for yourself or big daydreams. It's easy to be a judge of people in this regard, and we have to be very careful about that. But every now and then you'll hear someone say, and I promised God I would never again miss an opportunity to witness. I promised God I'd never again make that sin. Those are rash things to say. We live in an age of grace and forgiveness. That's characteristic of God in all ages, of course, but we live in a marked capacity of it. And the Lord, I'm sure, sometimes when we make the rash statements, well, I don't know how he feels, but I'm sure sometimes he must kind of chuckle and say, he won't last a month. But we ought not to do it. Our lives and quality are greatly enriched when we watch what we say and what we watch before God and what we promise. So the writer says, be confident before God, have a conduct before God that's honest. In verse 8, he tells us that we ought not to go to pieces when we see things in difficulty round about us. That's the concept of behavior. If you see oppression of the poor and violent perverting judgment, remember that God, the one who's higher, regards it and he'll take care of it. But don't go out and suddenly shoot all the oppressors, as I said a few chapters ago. What we are told with regard to behavior is that we'll have to trust God. We need not stand back and think he's forgotten us. We'll have to trust God. In verses 9 down through 13, the writer tells us not to be envious of the people who have great possessions and great things. He says the man who loves silver really isn't satisfied with silver. And when goods increase, they are increased to eat them. My wife and I often notice that. If we get some extra money, invariably a bill we didn't expect shows up to take care of it. I suppose there's a sense in which you might get a lot of extra things, but the writer says generally, when your goods increase, the causes that use them increase too. So down through verse 13 tells us that we should not be envious of others and what they have, not to learn to enjoy the sleep that comes from our work, and not to be selfish or greedy or envy those who are selfish and greedy, because those persons perish and leave nothing for those that come after them. We're told that in verse 14, avoid greed. Note the text of 14 and 15. Avoid greed. Riches perish by evil travail. One begets a son, there's nothing in his hand. He holds everything but has nothing to leave. Because as one comes forth of his mother's womb, naked returns he to the earth. This passage is cited by Paul in the letter to Timothy, when he reminds Timothy that we came with nothing and we go with nothing. Now in verse 18, you have a happy turn in thought. Verses 18 through 20 say, value the good gifts of God. Value them. Value the time God has given you. Value the provision God has given you. Value the power that God has given you to eat and drink. Don't worry about the days of your life in verse 20, but let God fill your heart with joy as you take what he's given and thank him for it. The importance of understanding is that I need to understand that my goods are best used when they're used for God. That my work effort is best meaningful when it's shared for others. That my fellowship is real when others are brought into my life in blessing. And that my character is good, bona fide, so to speak, when I'm willing to be taught. The concepts of behavior tie right to that. Therefore, being willing to be taught, let me walk wisely before God. In verse 8, let me trust him and not fall apart when things go wrong. In verses 9 through 13, let me not be envious of those who have tons of stuff. In verses 14 through 17, let me not be greedy or try to maintain a lot at God's expense. And in verses 18 and 20, very positively, let me value the good gifts that God gives and use them for him. Now chapter 6 is the fifth segment in this second discourse. And chapter 6 is an interesting chapter. Chapter 6 takes up the concept of satisfied living by filling our souls with good. It starts rather negatively, I suppose, when the writer says, I've seen an evil among men. There's a man to whom God has given riches, wealth, and honor so that he doesn't want anything, and yet God doesn't give him the power to eat. He's got everything, but God doesn't allow him to enjoy it. In verse 3, here's the man. He has 100 children, and that's considered to be a sign of prosperity in the Old Testament, and I think of the tax deductions he could get for 100 children. He lives many years. His days are many. But his soul is not filled with good, and nobody cares for him. Hence, he has no memorial. Nobody cares for him. He says it would have been better if he hadn't been born at all, in effect. The thrust is that the satisfied life is not one that lives long or has lots of stuff, but one that is filled with good. The writer says that the untimely birth is better because this man comes with vanity, and he departs with nothing, having known nothing of the blessings of this life involves. Now that's a rather pressing thought. If the soul is not filled with good, nothing else makes much sense or is much important. Then the writer goes ahead in verse 6 and tells us that no matter how long you live, all go to one place. That's not heaven or hell, that's the grave. And barring the Lord's interruption in some strange way, we all go to that place, the grave. From it, believers go to glory, and sinners go to hell. But all go to the grave. The writer says that a man works hard, and all of his labor goes to his mouth, but his appetite is not filled. Why not? Why not? Because his soul is not first filled with the good that God gives. And if a man lives like that, the wise man is not much better off than the fool. Oh, he says, it is better to see than to let yourself wander around in vexation and not have any idea of what you're doing. It's better to see than to do that. But when you can see everything in verse 10, then you will simply know that all that can be known has been seen or has been expressed. There are many things that increase vanity. How is man the better for them? The emphasis is drawn at the end of the chapter is that from who knoweth what is good for man in this life, all the days of a vain life which he spendeth in the shadow. Who can tell a man what shall be after him in this world under the sun? And the answer is almost a negative, nobody can. But yet Koheleth has already told us. What will be after a man is of no consequence. The important thing is how that man will live today. And consequently, the second discourse works very vigorously with the quality of life as lived before God. The writer says, if you want to improve your life, if you want to have it mean something, take the events of it and the time of it and consecrate them and dedicate them to God. See that there are differing destinies and be sure that your destiny is the one that God honors and that God designs. Understand the facts of your life so that you're able to apply them and to live openly. And then learn to behave in a proper sequence and patterns that God instructs and follow after those things that are good. If you do that, you'll have plenty of time. Your soul will rejoice in the good that God gives. You'll not be perplexed with the greed and corruption of this life. Your behavior will commend itself in your life to others, and you will be satisfied with the things that God gives. But any alteration will lead you into some kind of miserable and unknowing state. Life is ours to have and enjoy, but the having and enjoying are possible only as we live openly and thankfully before God. That is the heart of the second discourse of Ecclesiastes. We come at this time to our third discourse in the study of the book of Ecclesiastes. We have previously talked about the introductory factors of the book, talked about the first two of the four discourses that I discern in Ecclesiastes. The passage which we're studying today is Ecclesiastes 7, verse 1, through Ecclesiastes 9, verse 12. Sometimes the divisions in our material are just a little bit arbitrary. Every Bible student has the right, I suppose, to make the divisions in material where he thinks they fit best. The original chapters, as we find them in our Bibles, were made by men who analyzed the text and divided it up. None of that work was done in the Lord's day. All of it was done much, much later. So actually, when we give a particular verse of a chapter as a suggested point of terminus or end, what we're simply doing is trying to revise the material into units that we think better suits what we're trying to say. At least that's what I'm trying to do. In my own judgment, chapter 9 would be better off if it ended at verse 12. But since it doesn't, we make the end in our material at verse 12 and then pick up the fourth discourse somewhat later. So these four discourses are calculated to give us the view of life which the writer of Ecclesiastes thought would be important for us. And in Ecclesiastes 7:1 to Ecclesiastes 9:12, the presentation deals with life views. And the argument of Koheleth, the writer, is that you must bring your life views into agreement with God. Let me ramble with that just for a couple of moments. We have a tendency to want to control God, whether we like to admit it or not. We have a feeling that we'd like to make him like we are. And so we find ourselves often attributing to God our own attitudes and our own dispositions. Sometimes we conclude that if a thing is right for us or goes well for us, it must be right and ought to be proper for God. And I don't know how many times I've heard someone say, "The way this works for my good, it must be from God." Well, it may be and it may not be. But it's important in the language of Ecclesiastes to learn to bring our life views into agreement with God rather than trying to bring God into agreement with our life views. You have probably heard that said by someone else at some other time. It's a really important thing, and it's often stressed by men in the ministry as they talk about the spiritual life and about the life of victory and similar concepts. But no matter how much we say it, we cannot overemphasize the simple, basic truth My views of life in the world have got to be brought into agreement with the view which the Lord shows for himself. And that's what Koheleth is doing in Ecclesiastes 7:1 through Ecclesiastes 9:12. He's teaching us that we must bring our life views into agreement with the Lord. Now, we don't want to treat the section as though it were individualized and cut apart from the rest of the book. So you may remember that after the writer introduces the book to us and tells us about the problem that men are in as they find themselves transient in a stable universe, he stresses first the simple facts of life, reminding us that if they are not accepted, there can be no progress. And after that, he talks to us about the quality of life and emphasizes that God has given us life to enjoy, and we enjoy it only as we live it before God. So having begun with a simple basis of our transiency in this stable world, the writer says you must know and accept the facts of life, and then you must spiritually seek the quality of life that allows us to live it, enjoying the work of God. And then in this third discourse, he says, get rid of the unacceptable life views and bring your own view of life into acceptability before God. Make your life view agree with his. Now, when we speak of life view, by definition, we mean the way in which you look at life, the way in which you set your values, the way in which you determine things that are important or of greater or lesser interest to you. That's the concept of life view. Life view is not such a terribly philosophical or profound thing. It's simply the way in which one looks at life. Peter Rabbit, in the famous story of years ago, had a life view that taught him that getting stuff from McGregor's garden was what he wanted to do, no matter what his mother said or what McGregor said. His life view was vegetables from McGregor's garden. And poor old McGregor, for whom I've always felt a certain sympathy, having many rabbits eaten my garden, his view was that rabbits ought to be chopped with the hoe. That was gruesome, but that was his view. And so that's what life view is for all of us, too. It's the way in which we look at life and the way in which we hope to see life occupied. And the thrust of Ecclesiastes 7:1 through 9:12 is, bring your life views into agreement with God. Now, we'd like to break up the material in these three chapters into the segments that will allow us to treat them one at a time as we go through it. And I suppose that I will start by mentioning that there are actually five sections of material in the section from 7:1 through 9:12. Five sections. Let me mention what each of these is, and what its essential content is, and what its essential point is. And then when we've looked at all five of them, let us come back and pick them up verse by verse as much as we're able to, and look at them particularly. The first section in this matter of life view is in Ecclesiastes 7, 1 through 10. Here we have what I have often called the Proverbs of Irony. Like when the writer says it's better to go to the house of mourning than to the house of feasting. That's not the way a lot of us look at it. It's ironic that mourning would be more important than rejoicing. The Proverbs of Irony. And these Proverbs of Irony are intended to teach us true earthly values. By earthly, we don't not mean wicked. By earthly, we mean human in the world where we live. So in Ecclesiastes 7, 1 through 10, we have the Proverbs of Irony, which are intended to teach us true earthly values. Not, as I will say in a few minutes, the values that men set for us or that we set for ourselves, but earthly values which are important in the sight of God and which have lasting merit to them. That's what we mean by true earthly values. Values that conform to the reality of life and have lasting meaning to them. The second segment is Ecclesiastes 7, verses 11 through 29. It's a long section. A long section in which you are given the portrait of wisdom. Ecclesiastes 7, verses 11 through 29. The portrait of wisdom. And in this particular section, we are given the concept of the reality of a life control, a life content. That's how I like to speak of it. The writer will emphasize wisdom and the things that we ought to know and how we ought to apply it, both to the things we do and to the things that we don't do. But he will be giving us a portrait of wisdom, and in so doing, will be showing us the true life content, what life ought to be built of. The problem that we often face in Ecclesiastes is that the writer tries to build life on experiences and indulgences and pleasures and many things and never really finds much satisfaction in them. So in this portion in chapter 7, the writer brings together a number of striking facets to give us the true content of life, the portrait of wisdom. Then the third section in this particular part of material is in Ecclesiastes chapter 8, verses 1 through 11. And here we are given true life performance, the conduct before God and man. Hope that isn't confusing to you, but what we're really saying is that you have to bring your life views into agreement with God. Your values, your life content, your life performance must all agree with what God wants them to be if they are to be meaningful or lasting.
In Ecclesiastes 8, 1 through 11, the conduct before God and man is sketched very heavily. Of course, we often talk about the way we behave before God, and we sometimes talk about the way we behave before men. And sometimes we kind of forget all of those things too. But Koheleth says that life views involve all of your conduct before God and before man almost at the same time. And it's necessary that we learn what the true performance in life is. That's what we learn in Ecclesiastes 8, 1 through 11. In Ecclesiastes 8, 12 through 17, we have a section that takes up true spiritual values. And this particular section stresses the nature of well-being. Now in 7, verses 1 through 10, we had true earthly values, things that are real and lasting as far as life is concerned. And now in 8, verses 12 through 17, we have true spiritual values, things that are true in our heart and soul and mature us as far as God and life is concerned. And then in the last of our sections in this passage, which is chapter 9, verses 1 through 12, we have the life end consequences and a true world view. I hate to overuse the word true, but I'm using it in the sense of that which conforms to fact and to reality. And here we get a world view in chapter 9, which stresses key things with regard to life and death and reward and how we use our energies and skills before God. So the thrust of the chapters is just simply to teach us to bring our life views into agreement with the Lord. If we're unwilling to do that, we may still have our own life views, but they are not satisfying or meaningful. That's what was wrong, among other things, with the rich fool in the gospel account. His life view was building barns and getting goods. But one night the Lord said to him, "Your soul will be required of you," and the barns and goods meant nothing to him then. In the book of Proverbs, the life view of the fool is having a good time and being wise in his own conceit. But the life view of a respectful person is fearing God and doing his will. And until we bring our life views into agreement with God, we are very likely to spend all of our days working on some selfish or some tedious issue, working on some project that cannot succeed or bring us very little peace or lasting satisfaction. Kind of trite terms, but we work on those things until we can bring our life view, into agreement with what God's Word gives and what the Lord teaches us. Now we may go ahead and discuss the section at some length. We begin by going back to chapter 7 and verse 1, and looking at the realities here, as the writer of Ecclesiastes teaches us true earthly values in a series of proverbs of irony. I'm reading from the King James Version, and I will read these first 10 verses just to give us a feeling for them. "A good name is better than precious ointment, and the day of one's death is better than the day of one's birth. It is better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting, for that is the end of all men, and the living will lay it to his heart. Sorrow is better than laughter, for by sadness of the countenance the heart is made better. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of fools is in the house of mirth. It's better to hear the rebuke of the wise than for a man to hear the song of fools. For as the crackling of thorns under a pot, so is the laughter of the fool. This also is vanity. Surely oppression maketh a wise man mad, and a gift destroyeth the heart. Better is the end of a thing than the beginning thereof, and the patient in spirit is better than the proud in spirit. Be not hasty in thy spirit to be angry, for anger resteth in the bosom of fools. Say not thou, what is the cause that the former days were better than these, for thou dost not inquire wisely concerning this." Now those, friends, are what we call the Proverbs of Irony. There are some others in Ecclesiastes similar to them, but they are particularly unique in this setting in helping us with regard to true earth values. There are 5 true earthly values sketched in these 10 verses. We mention them in this order. First is the value of a good name. That's in verse 1. Second is the value of sobriety, found in verse 2. Third is the true value of being instructed, found in the concept of verses 5, 6, 7. And then is the concept of integrity, found largely in the latter half of verse 7 and verse 8. And finally, the concept of satisfaction, found in verses 9 and 10. Those are earthly values. If we put them around in slightly different language, we'd say the things you really ought to value are an honest name, a sober spirit, a well-taught soul, a life of integrity, and a sense of satisfaction with what you do. True earth values. I suppose that if we worked on those a bit, we could make them almost poetic and get them into a neater scheme of things. But they are just the very sort of things that man in his flesh mocks and doesn't worry much about. So we have people who are concerned for building a name for themselves, but not often a good name. A name that's associated with God and associated with merit and associated with blessing. We have many persons active in the popular world about us sometimes professional persons, sometimes entertainers, who want to be well known. But that is not necessarily a good name. The concept of good name is a name that is known for good, a name that's associated with truth, and the writer says there is a real value. I'm not a particularly good Shakespearean quoter, but I remember well the analysis in Othello when Iago, the villain, talks about his good name. And he says very effectively, he says, "He who steals my purse steals trash, but he who takes my good name..." "Ah," says Othello then in a rambling discourse, "he takes something from me that he can't use and that I can't afford to lose." Well, what Iago says, villain or not, is very true. A good name is better than almost anything else. But note in Ecclesiastes 7:1, a good name is better than precious ointment. Now, the precious ointment can be understood in several ways, but I have usually understood it as the oil that was used in the anointing of persons to special service by God. That is not a necessary understanding, but that's the way I've understood it. And the writer is saying a good name is better than to have public acclaim and to be anointed with the anointing oil that makes you stand out above all others. Precious ointment. The good name is better than that because, of course, the good name is what is yours eternally. And all of the precious ointment in the world is only yours until it dries up or is lost or rots or a cat eats it or something like that happens. The precious ointment is very limited in what it can do for you. You might sell it, you might anoint with it, but sooner or later it's gone. But the good name is the mark of your quality. That's the true earthly value. Now, when we say earthly, we mean that it is not wicked or secular, but that it's here. And not in heaven, but among your colleagues now, among your neighbors, among your friends, to be known as a person of good is of greater value than precious ointment or gems or any other physical thing you might possess. Now, having said that, in the first phrase of Ecclesiastes 7:1, the writer goes ahead and says things that bother some people. The day of death is better than one's birth. Then he says that it's better to go to the house of mourning, the house of feasting. And then he says in verse 3 that sorrow is better than laughter, for by the sadness of the countenance the heart is made better. In all of these particular sayings, the writer is telling us a truth. And that is that the great value in life is sobriety rather than the giddy emotion that runs so much of our society. The day of death is better than one's birth in that, at that point, life is concluded and there won't be any more stupid blunders in it. The house of mourning, more important than the house of feasting, because in the house of mourning you can reflect soberly and you can correct your life in the truth of what you know. Consequently, the wise man's heart is there in mourning. The fools go out and have a good time and don't care about life, eternity, or even the present very much. Sobriety does not deny the right of having fun in life. It doesn't deny the privilege of enjoying your friends and colleagues and associations. But sobriety says you look at things from the point of view of eternal values chiefly. Hence, the day of death is better than the day of birth. Some evangelical scholars think that means that because on the day of death you go to heaven. I'm not sure that that's what's being taught. I'm sure that's what happens to the believer, but I'm not sure that's what's being taught here. I think what's being taught here is that your life is completed at the day of death. The challenges, the tests, the sins, the giddiness of this world are over. And consequently, there's no longer temptation and destiny and disapproval in those things. Certainly for the believer, there's reward in eternity with God. But the proverb says a good name is better than anything else. That is in the earthly sense. And sobriety is a value highly to be treasured. Then, says the writer, you ought to be instructed. That's a value, to be instructed. And so you hear the rebuke of the wise more than the song of fools. The rebuke of the wise suggests the correction is brought to your life by someone who knows more than you do. Wisdom in this particular book and in other books in the Old Testament as well usually indicates the ability to take the knowledge you have and solve the problems of life. So the wise man is someone who knows more than you do. And you hear the rebuke of the wise. I remember once when we moved into a new house when the oil furnace would not fire one night. I felt like firing it. It would not fire for me. It wouldn't come on. And it was kind of a cool night. We weren't dying from exposure, but it was a cool night and we wanted some heat. And I had done several things to the furnace. I hadn't kicked it yet, but I'd done several other things. And I called a man who in our community came and served those burners. And when he got to the house, he walked into the hall confidently and pointed a switch out in the wall to me, and he said, "Did anybody touch this switch?" And I said, "I certainly didn't touch it," which was true. I never touch switches. He said, "Someone has turned it off." Well, perhaps it had been one of my children. Who knows for sure? But sure enough, somebody had turned off a switch that I hadn't even seen that turned off the burner. So he turned it, and the burner came on immediately and began to heat. And he said to me, in a nice way, but he said it to me meaningfully, he said, "I'm glad to come and help you, but," he said, "you ought to look at the switch first." Well, I took that as a word of truth. And any time in the next 17 years that I lived there or needed his services, before I called him, I went and looked at the switch first. He was wise about that. And it was far better to hear that than to hear the crackling of fools. Somebody else might say, "Kiddly, oh, just call him. That's what he's paid for. Call him to get the job done," and chuckle about it. But it's better to hear the rebuke of the wise. It's a value in life to be instructed. And to have someone who will teach you is to be encouraged, not to have a bunch of foundering puppies who will stay around and flatter you in strange ways. But to be taught and instructed is a great value in life. It's an unhappy person who has no one to instruct or teach. And then in verses 7 and 8, the writer takes up the fourth true value, the matter of integrity. Oppression makes the wise man mad. A gift destroys the heart. Gift is certainly bribe in this capacity, a gift that perverts your judgment. And things that are heavy make the wise man mad because he's unable to cope with them. His wisdom does not allow him to get rid of them. The gift comes, and the heart is soon destroyed. Now, in the connection with that, although the passage is slender, I think, but in connection with that is a thought that you do not allow yourself to be bent by that which is wrong, and you do not allow yourself to be compromised in the positions of life which will be harmful to you or to what you stand for. The gift destroys the heart. You take an accession from someone, you make some type of a commitment which prejudices your stand or perjures your soul, and you never really recover from it. Your integrity, like your good name, is something you cannot afford to lose. And finally, the writer says, don't be angry in your spirit. And above all else, don't stand back and say, "Why was yesterday better than today?" because you're not wise when you do that. This is a matter of satisfaction. You learn to live today thankful for what it is before God, knowing full well that whatever yesterday was, it's past, and you can't bring it back. Now, in a nutshell, Ecclesiastes 7, 1 through 10 says, have true earth values. Value a good name, value a sober spirit, value the instruction that might come from wise persons toward you, value a character of integrity, and value with satisfaction what God gives you to do day by day. Those concepts are all elaborated on in other passages of Ecclesiastes that we will take up sometime later when we look at that particular thing. But that's very important here. If your life views are going to be brought into agreement with God's, you will have to accept the standard of earth values, which is right first of all. The second section in our treatment in this third discourse is that which we find in Ecclesiastes 7, 11 through 29. It's the portrait of wisdom. And this portrait of wisdom is to give us true life content. Life content. Well, life content is all that stuff that you put into your heart and into your mind and your ambition and into your work. Life content is how you are in your living and what your goals are and where you hope to retire and how many fishing cottages you hope to go to. All of that is part of life content. It's your education, it's your spiritual exercise, all of that is part of life content. But in Ecclesiastes 7, 11 through 29, the true life content is wisdom, and so we are given this striking picture of the wisdom. In particular, wisdom is given to us in a threefold sense in Ecclesiastes in this passage. In verses 11 and 12 of chapter 7, wisdom is our protector. In verses 13 through 18, wisdom is our advisor. And in verses 19 through 29, wisdom is our practical guide in all that we do in life. And that's the portrait of wisdom. If somebody said, draw me a picture of wisdom on the basis of this scripture, if you wanted a full treatment of wisdom, there are many other scriptures you'd have to look at. But if someone said, draw me a portrait of wisdom, you would try to depict the portrait of one who is protecting and advising and practically instructing the subject in all the necessary turns of life. That's what wisdom is. And true life content is having wisdom locked in your heart and bound in your members and guiding the things that have to be done day by day. So there's the portrait of wisdom. And just as in the first part of Ecclesiastes 7, we are instructed to have true life values, here we are instructed to have a true life content, a content of wisdom, not things or self-aggrandizement, but a content of wisdom. Let's look at some of the verses in somewhat shorter and closer detail. Verse 11 and verse 12, we're given the view of wisdom as a protector. Wisdom is good with an inheritance. By it there is profit to them that see the sun. But the writer had told us back in chapter 2 that one of the tough things about leaving your worldly goods was that you did not know who'd inherit them, whether it would be a wise man or a fool. You work hard to get something and leave it to a fool, and the writer says, this is a great grief. And so when inheritance is given, wisdom is good if it comes with it, because wisdom in verse 12 is a defense. Well, says the writer, money is a defense too. And then he argues with himself and says, the excellency of wisdom is, of knowledge is, that wisdom giveth life to them that have it. Money's a defense, someone says. But, says the writer, the excellency of knowledge, wisdom gives life to them that have it. Money cannot do that. Money may enrich to a certain degree what you already have, or may drag it out to a certain extent. But money is just a thing. Wisdom is a living life force. And in that sense, it protects you from the folly of squandering what is yours, and it protects you from the folly of not knowing what it is that you have. That's why we say in this passage, wisdom is a protector. It stands as a wall. It stands as a defense. It stands as a shield against those things, both internally and externally, that would tend to destroy what is yours and what's given to you. You'll occasionally see someone who's given a great deal of money and doesn't have wisdom to know how to use it. It can sometimes ruin them, and ruin them rapidly. But if wisdom is there, well, speaking as I do and working at Biblical Theological Seminary, we'd like nothing more than the opportunity to demonstrate wisdom with a good inheritance. We'd like nothing more than that for somebody to leave us a big bundle and then to have the wisdom to know how to use it for the work of God. Wisdom defends you against self-will, defends you against the loss and the frustrations of life. It defends you against those things in a way that physical goods never can, because the physical goods are not alive. They are things and they will be gone. But wisdom is living and powerful, and, of course, in a fuller biblical sense, is the very beginning of the knowledge of God. However, wisdom is not only a protector, it is also an advisor. And this advice role comes out in verses 13 and the verses that follow down through verse 18. You look at the work of God. We are told that nobody can undo what God has done in verse 13. Then we are told in verse 14 that in the day of prosperity we ought to be happy. And when the day of adversity comes, we ought to remember that God has given us both of them, that they might balance one another. There has to be some thinking along that line. Everybody rejoices in the day of prosperity. But, says the writer of Ecclesiastes, wisdom, true life content, teaches you that God balances days of prosperity with days of adversity. He does that to the end that you cannot make your own lot in life. Man can find nothing after him. If your life was totally good, you would surfeit yourself in abundant places. If life was totally bad, you'd destroy yourself in self-despair. So God brings balance to your life that you will look to him and not to yourself. That's what wisdom teaches us. Wisdom says when you're having a good day, rejoice in it. But remember, there will be adverse days too, so be thankful for them. God brings the two to you to balance your life. That's how wisdom advises us. It advises us also in verse 15 that we don't always get exactly what we think we ought to get. A just man sometimes perishes, and a wicked man sometimes goes on. Consequently, one should not feel dismayed if it happens. You may not like it, but that is the way it goes. Those things happen. An individual should not, therefore, act overly indignant in verse 16 and maybe destroy himself. You shouldn't look out and act like you're directing the world rather than God is and say, God, if you can't do it my way, I wish you'd try something else. No, wisdom advises us that in the course of life, there are many injustices that can't be corrected immediately, and we should not try, or we will destroy ourselves with our over-righteousness. Says the writer, it's good that you take hold of this. It's good that you reach out with both hands and get a grip on it, because he who fears God will come forth with them all. And that's what wisdom really advises us. Wisdom advises us to fear God, be content with his work. Don't try to rule his universe, but to fear him. Wisdom advises us on those things, and that's the true content of life. That will tie in very closely with what we say about true spiritual values in a couple of minutes, but that's the content of life, that sort of wisdom. And then as the chapter proceeds, the practical side of wisdom is seen in verses 19 through 25. We are told a kind of a humorous note in these verses. Of course, the verse that we read in verse 20 is not humorous. It reminds us that there's not a just man that doeth good and sinneth not. Wisdom teaches us that practically. Wisdom teaches us that no man is totally trustworthy. Oh, wisdom strengthens the wise more than 10 mighty men strengthen the city. But among all of them, there is no one who is totally just and righteous. Apart from the Lord, of course. But no one of our flesh and blood is totally righteous. However, says wisdom, when you're in a circumstance where someone speaks evil of you, don't worry too much about it. You're told that in verses 21 and 22. Here's the retributory laws, the laws of retribution, I think might be the way to say it, that if you hear somebody speak evil of you, don't worry about it. Remember that once you spoke evil of them, wisdom teaches us not to go around trying to set any course of life straight on all details. And then in verses 23 through 29, wisdom teaches us something about the fellowship of life. These verses are sometimes not well understood, I think, and I cannot go into them in great detail. But the writer says of a woman, verse 26, I find more bitter than death the woman whose heart is snares and nets and her hands is bands. Whoso pleaseth God shall escape from her, but the sinner shall be taken by her. That seems to be the crafty woman spoken of in Proverbs who seeks to lead astray. The writer of Ecclesiastes goes on and talks about how he only finds one man among a thousand he can trust and doesn't find any women. You have to remember who's writing. You have to remember who's writing. You kind of have to remember the women that clustered about the court. He is not giving a generalization against all womanhood or all manhood. He's saying that wisdom has instructed us practically not to look for the ultimate companionship of life among men and women. It will be found in God. God made man upright. They found many ways to get around that, he said. But that's what wisdom teaches me practically. It teaches me that the character of all men is sinful. It teaches me that I will likely in life be treated as I have treated others. And it teaches me that the fellowship in life cannot be found ultimately in men, but has to be found in God. Therefore, the content of life, the true content, is wisdom. Looking to God, listening to Him, and being bound by His will and by His ways. Now let's put those two together just for a moment. Look, says the writer, your life views have to be brought in line with God's. First, you have to set true earthly values, the good name and so forth. And then you have to build a life with a content that is true to the nth degree. And the content that marks it is wisdom. The wisdom spoken of by James, it comes from high. Wisdom, the fear and the respect of God, the application of all God gives into the practice of life. Now in chapter 8, in verses 1 through 11, we pick up the third section. Here we have conduct before God and man. Here we have the true life performance. The true life performance. I've enjoyed this chapter so much that I tend to rhapsodize on it and not get over all the material, but it is really remarkable what the writer tells us. He gives us particular notes along this line with regard to true life performance, conduct before God and man. He teaches us in verse 1 that we ought to be marked by confidence. We ought to be marked by confidence. We know something of God, and our faces should shine and show it. In verse 2, he tells us that we ought to be marked by obedience. In verse 3, that we ought to be marked by understanding. In verses 6 and 7, that we ought to be marked by purpose. And in verses 8 through 11, that we should be marked by thoughtfulness. These are true performance codes in conduct before God and man. Look at each of them rather rapidly with me. Who's the wise man, says the writer? Who knoweth the interpretation of a thing? Those are rhetorical questions. He's not asking for someone's name. He's saying, who is this person? And then he says, a man's wisdom maketh his face to shine, and the boldness of his face shall be changed. Therefore, he says, if you have true life content, then you're able to perform truly. You show confidence. You are wise, and your face beams it. You are courageous, and your face demonstrates it. They say sometimes that dogs can detect fear in persons. I don't really know if that's true or not. I suppose if it weren't true, not everybody would say it. I don't know. But I have sometimes noticed that. I've sometimes noticed that a dog is very much bothered by the way you look. Now, we'll not get into a long dog talk now, but you know, find a giant shepherd with a nasty disposition. Get down on your hands and knees and growl at him a couple of times. Don't sue me when he bites your nose off, but try it sometime. You'll discover that the way in which you manifest yourself very positively tells others what's in your heart and life. And so the man who's wise shows confidence. The same thing is true with regard to obedience. He keeps the king's command in verse 2 with regard to the oath of God. But when he's in the presence of the king in verses 3 and 5, he doesn't act nervous or run back and forth because he knows that the king will be suspicious of him and his life will be jeopardized. In true performance, he's confident, he's obedient, he's understanding. In verses 6 and 7, he's purposeful. He knows that there's time and judgment to every purpose. And he doesn't really know when his own end shall be, so he lives in the light of it. And in verses 8 through 11, he is thoughtful, thoughtful. He knows that he cannot stretch out his life in verse 8. There's no discharge in the life-death war. He knows he cannot stretch it out. And since he cannot stretch it out, since he sees the wicked buried, since he cannot stretch it out, he sits back and determines to allow God to deal with him justly and not to do like the wicked who try to multiply their wickedness in the hope of getting ahead of God. So true performance is a matter of a conduct before God and man that is godly and practical. And that's the life view. Look at how you perform. The life view is, how do you perform? What are your goals? What are your standards? True performance is a conduct before God and man that is commendable to both. Now in the last part of chapter 8, in verses 12 through 17, true spiritual values are set forth. Here we have the nature of our well-being as a general subject, and the spiritual values are threefold. In verses 12 and 13, they are the simple matter of knowing God. In verses 14 and 15, it is the matter of rejoicing in him. And verses 16 and 17, it's the matter of allowing him to work. Why, says the writer, if a man lives a long time, verse 12, and no matter what else happens to him, I know that it will be well with them that fear God, but it will not be well with the wicked. It is just that simple. Knowing God is the true spiritual value. Sometimes when you look around and see the wicked prospering and having everything their way, you imagine that if you were wicked, things would be better for you too. No, says the writer. True spiritual value is knowing God. Verses 14 and 15 is rejoicing in him. I commended mirth. Mirth is the only fun word in Ecclesiastes that has a nice side to it. Sometimes it's used poorly, but sometimes it's also used with a nice side. It's the only one of these fun words that has that. But I commended rejoicing, because there's nothing better for a man under the sun than to enjoy what God has given him, to enjoy it and to use it for God. That's rejoicing in God. You may not have much. It isn't how much you have, it's your attitude towards it. You may not have much, but as we used to sing in a little children's chorus, little is much if God is in it. And if the individual recognizes what he has from God and rejoices in it, he is a greatly blessed and a very happy individual. And then in allowing God to work, we look out and see that men cannot know all the work that God does, no matter how much they try to seek to find it out. A wise man can't know it all, no matter how hard he tries. So you sit back in a kind of a prayerful way and allow God to work. You allow God to run his universe, his work. You yourself are desirous of true life content and true earthly values, but you allow God to work. And in so doing, you demonstrate the reality of true spiritual values, knowing God, rejoicing in him, allowing him to work. I might say that all of those things can be amplified very heavily in the New Testament. I've often made a parallel between them and the teachings of the Lord Jesus in Matthew chapter 6. It is a very beautiful and striking parallel. But for the moment, I have not time to go into it. I'll simply tell you that it's there. The concept of these three true spiritual values does not exhaust the subject of spiritual values, but they open the door to a world of wonder and excitement where people find out that the real life view is knowing God and rejoicing in the knowledge and work of him. Our final segment in this third discourse is found in Ecclesiastes 9, 1 through 12. It's what I like to refer to as the true world view. It talks about life, the life end consequences, how life goes and what the consequences are. And here's the true world view in a section of Ecclesiastes where we are to bring our life views into agreement with God. The chapter, verses 1 through 12, breaks itself down into four major sections. In verses 1 through 3, we have the reality of providence. In verses 4 through 6, we have the priority of life. In verses 7 through 10, we have the use of life. And in verses 11 through 12, we have the design of providence. It breaks down into four sections rather quickly summarized like that. In verses 1 through 3, in the reality of providence, the writer simply says, I know that one thing comes to all, that's death. All die. Now most assuredly, there may come a time when some do not die. Some may be called to the presence of God, but the force of life, so far as we know it, all die. All things come alike to all die. Death is just as common for the righteous as it is for the saint, as it is for the sinner, it just comes, that's all. But it's in the hands of God. In the hand of God. So the wise and the righteous and all others are in the hand of God. And apart from the hand of God, no man has knowledge of any of those things. Now that's not a fatalistic thing, but that's the reality of providence. That is simply acknowledging the authority and the right of God as king over the universe. However, when the writer has said that, he concludes in verses 4 through 6 that it's still better than being alive. We have seen some verses in Ecclesiastes where he says that the day of one's death is better than the day of one's birth. And in its context, I think we can understand what he means by that. But here he says that as long as you're alive, verses 4 through 6 of chapter 9, as long as you're alive, there's hope for you. There's hope that you might see what God wants you to be and what God wants you to do. There's hope that you might direct your way towards him. There's hope for you as long as you're alive. Some object to a phrase like the one you have in Ecclesiastes 9:4, a living dog is better than a dead lion. But the truth of the matter is that that's right. A dead lion does nothing. A living dog, there's hope that he may improve. There's hope he may grow. Who knows what may happen? Where there is life, there is the possibility of growth. There's also the possibility of sin. But here the writer is talking of the possibility of growth. When he says the living know that they shall die, but the dead know not anything, he is not teaching a soul sleep doctrine. He's simply saying that the dead do not come back here and do anything anymore. We believe our departed loved ones are with the Lord Jesus. We believe they know a lot of things, but they do not know of our lives in an experimental sense. If you and a friend are building a house and he suddenly dies, he will not help you finish the house. That's the point of it. Don't tell me his spirit will help you. My experience with spirit driving nails has been very bad so far. He will not help you build a house. He will be gone. He will do nothing anymore as far as the house is concerned. Don't imagine, as do some cultists, that these verses teach a dissolution of all of our being, that in the grave you're suddenly gone. They teach that as far as the world is concerned, we are gone. And this is the place of activity. Spirits do not come back and finish telling sermons or writing books. Living people do those things. So the priority of life is that while you're alive, you may serve God. When you're dead, the records are simply closed. Have that true world view of life. Don't despise your life. Don't hate it. Don't wish that it were over. Don't imagine that you'd be better off if you were older. But see that while you have life, you have it that you might use it for the glory and honor of God. That carries us into verses 7 through 10, where the use of life is given in the true world view. Here we are told to enjoy, in verse 7 and 8, what God has given us. In verse 9, to enjoy the family that God has given us. And in verse 10, to enjoy and use all the opportunities of life that God has given us. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might. You're not going to have an opportunity to do it again. As I said a moment ago, in the grave, you are not going to finish making that grandfather's clock that you've been playing with in the basement for 15 years. In the grave, you're not going to do it. So do it now. That's the use of life. Live thankfully, live rejoicingly, live fully for God in the course of life. The writer says in conclusion of this chapter in verses 11 and 12, I returned and I saw that the men that were fast didn't always win the race. The reality of providential control is that God works things out to his own end and purpose, and many things cannot be predicted or governed or quieted by us. Many must simply be accepted. And since we don't know our time and don't know our day, we look up to God and say, Lord, I will trust you in the leading and guiding of it, whatever it happens to be. Now, these life-end consequences force upon us a true worldview. That true worldview is to see that providence is real, that our life is to be used for God, that our energies are used now or never, and that we can trust God with all the details and outcomes of life. In conclusion of this particular section, the argument is that you must bring your life views into agreement with the Lord. You must not have a set of earthly standards which will not last. You must not have a content that is vague or vaporous. You must not have a performance that is wicked or weak. You must not have spirit values that are purely carnal in their scope. And you must not have a world view which sees only your own self as being important. All of those things are contrary to God. He in the Word urges us to have true values in name and sobriety and teaching. He urges us to have true life content in letting wisdom and the knowledge of him guide and control us. He urges us to have a true performance in which before both God and man we are honest and well served. He urges us to have true spiritual values so that we may show the nature of well-being before God for the blessing of others. And he urges upon us a true life view so that life and its consequences may be viewed in the hope of what we can do for God and how God will bless us. This concludes the third discourse in Ecclesiastes. We have one further discourse beyond this, and then an attempt to summarize much of the teaching of the book in its themes. So we will discontinue until we have opportunity to resume with the fourth discourse.
This series is continued on the next cassette. Other helpful cassettes are available from Biblical Theological Seminary. For a free copy of our cassette catalog or other information about the seminary, please write to Biblical Theological Seminary, 200 North Main Street, Hatfield, Pennsylvania, zip code 19444.